Good afternoon. The time is just about 3 o'clock, and you are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau. I'm Jeff Brown here with the Juneau Afternoon. Today we'll talk with founders KTOO, Frederick Hoskinson, Dennis Harris, and John Corso as we celebrate 40 years of public broadcasting here in Alaska's capital city. Also, Raiders Almanac Bird Note and get an update on Eagle Crest. Reminder that tonight at 7 on KTOO News, Governor Sean Parnell's State of the State address live from the Capitol building. The forecast for today, more rain with high temperatures around 46 degrees. 42 degrees tonight. Forecast for Thursday, more rain diminishing in the afternoon with high temperatures around 45 degrees. Friday, mostly cloudy skies with high temperatures around 43 degrees.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Osage Nation leader has been removed from office. KGOU's Kurt Gorney reports on what prompted the action.
Osage Nation Principal Chief John D. Red Eagle was forced from office by members of the Tribal Congress after a trial that supported 5 of 6 counts of wrongdoing against him. Red Eagle's ouster on Tuesday came after a trial that started January 13th. The Tribal Congress also voted 11-0 with one abstention to disqualify Red Eagle from holding any future elected or appointed office with the tribe.
By 5-6 votes of the Congress, votes to disqualify Chief Red Eagle from holding and enjoying any office of honor, trust, or profit in the Osage Nation.
The 6 counts against the chief included his alleged interfering with an Osage Attorney General's investigation and refusing to uphold tribal law. Other charges include withholding information properly requested under the Osage Nation's Open Records Act by 2 newspapers and breaking federal and tribal laws. Supporters of Red Eagle say the chief's removal is purely political. Assistant Chief Scott Bighorse was sworn in to replace Red Eagle. An election for the Osage Nation's principal chief is set for March. For National Native News, I'm Kurt Gortney.
The Indian Health Service says there has been no hepatitis or HIV outbreak on the Fort McDermitt Paiute and Shoshone Reservation in northern Nevada. As Tristan Autone reports, tribal leaders raised concerns after a health test.
Between December 23rd and January 7th, an IHS employee on the Fort McDermitt Reservation allegedly used a blood sugar tester inappropriately. The device pierces the skin to draw blood and may have been improperly cleaned of blood and used on 21 patients, leaving tribal officials worried that tribal members may have been exposed to hepatitis B, C, and HIV. Charles Reedhead is chief medical officer for the IHS Phoenix Area Office.
There's no known outbreak of hepatitis or HIV right now at Fort McDermitt. We are here to look at patients who received testing with this device and going to check and make sure that they didn't experience an infection because of what happened.
IHS says the investigation is ongoing. For National Native News, I'm Tristan Autown.
The explosive contents of Department of Defense barrels dumped into Lake Superior during the Cold War have been recovered and disposed. Mike Simonson has more.
The Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior Ojibwe has been working for more than a decade to remove some of the 1,400-plus munitions barrels from Lake Superior's bottom. Using grants from the Department of Defense's cleanup fund, Red Cliff has pinpointed most of those drums dumped a few miles northeast of Duluth. In August of 2012, an expert recovery team pulled up 25 barrels. 3 of the barrels had melted munitions parts, but the other 22 each contained up to 700 explosive ejection cups used in cluster bombs. They weren't prepared to recover explosives, so they put the contents in lined barrels and returned them to the lake. Last September, with permits from federal and state agencies, they pulled the barrels up, took them to a secure dock in Duluth, and transported them to a disposal facility in Sauget, Illinois. Red Cliff had the contents of the barrels examined for human and environmental risks, and they're reviewing reports. Then they'll decide if some or all of the half-century-old barrels should be removed. They'll decide that by August. The dump area is in the tribal ceded territory of Lake Superior, giving them the right and the tribe's, say, duty to protect that sacred area. For National Native News, I'm Mike Simonson.
In January 2013, a meeting was held between First Nations leaders and Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper. It came after Idle No More protests and a hunger strike by a Native leader. The meeting to address First Nations issues divided leaders and was boycotted by many chiefs. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. The Convention and Tourism Department of the Albuquerque Hispano Chamber of Commerce provides convention and event planning services for Native American organizations. Information at ahcnm.org. Every Alaskan can support causes and organizations they care about when they file for a permanent fund dividend. Use PICCLICKGIVE when filing online for your PFD. With one donation at a time, good things will happen all over Alaska. Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Service.
You're listening to KTOO Stereo FM Radio for Juneau, Alaska. K2 is owned by the people who listen to it and operated by the people who own it. You're a listener right now. You can become an owner by joining Capital Community Broadcasting Incorporated, and you can become an operator by volunteering your time. If you'd like to know more about owning and operating, keep listening. If you'd like to know more about listening, see an audiologist.
That's John Corso from 1974, and we'll be joining John Corso as well as Dennis Harris and myself. I'm Frederick, right after this.
Actually, let's go to John right now.
All right.
John Corso, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, guys. Pleasure to be with you.
Hi.
So John Corso and Frederick Hoskinson are here by the telephone and also in the studio to talk about KTOO's history. It started in January 26th of 1974. Is that correct, Frederick?
Yeah, there's a little bit of controversy because it was awfully close to midnight, so it was almost January 27th.
Well, but I managed to wire it all back together just in time. I couldn't figure out why everybody was nagging me to finish rewiring the patch bay, which had some problems, because we'd only been doing, like, test authority that we couldn't do any programming, so we were playing horrible music just to know that we had a signal, and I had, we'd gone off the air, and I was rewiring the patch bay, and everybody's saying, come on, Dennis, get it done.
Well, I had the telegram already that said we could go.
And I did not know until they opened the microphone and Frederick said, program test authority. And I said, no, it's not program test authority. And Elaine held up the telegram in front of my face, and then I realized, oh, we're on the air.
Elaine Mitchell. First of all, when did the seat from starting a public radio station germinate?
Well, a bunch of us had been working at KJNO. And
including guy Linda Ellerby, who's well known.
She was one of the founding people too. And we had started doing some interesting things, especially after midnight, broadcasting all night long after midnight with people that came in and worked for free just because they wanted to do something different on the radio. And the station was doing fairly well financially. But the owner of the station, Roy Pascal, who most people remember as the owner of KJNO, living here, but at the time he lived in Sitka, and he had this habit of coming over about every 6 months and firing everybody and then hiring a few of the people back and hiring a few more new people, and he did this about every 6 months. He came over and fired everybody, and so we thought, well, it's time for us to start our own radio station.
He didn't fire me. But
he didn't fire you. You were the only one left, I think.
I quit 3 months later.
But we went ahead and in the meantime, the Whole Earth Catalog had a book listed in there called Sex and Broadcasting by a guy named Lorenzo Milam, the guy that had founded KRAB in Seattle, and a bunch of other stations, along with Jeremy Lanceman, who now owns KYES TV up in Anchorage. And
we should make it clear that the book was neither about sex nor broadcasting.
That's right. It was about broadcasting, but not about sex. Because what it was a handbook on how to start a low-power nonprofit radio station. And so Elaine read the book, got the paperwork from the FCC. We filled out all the forms, sent the stuff up to Washington. And while we were waiting, we began doing a number of other things. Among other things, we started raising some money, had a fundraising concert. And I went off to Cordova and ran the radio station up there for about almost a year while we were waiting to get on the air. And in a year and a half or so that we were waiting for all the permits to come through and everything and order equipment and all that kind of stuff, we began to build support for the idea of the station in town. And by the time we went on the air, we had quite a few people already volunteering and ready, because Frederick and Elaine and I helped the year before we went on the air in 73, the legislative session of 1973, we covered the legislature. Elaine and I were reporters. Frederick was our producer, busy editing tape while we were running around with tape recorders and doing the first statewide legislative coverage on the radio. It ran on KOTZ in Kotzebue, KYUK in Bethel, and KUAC up in Fairbanks, with no local outlet here.
Well, I might add that we got a big, heavy, portable, sort of portable, it took 2 men and a boy to carry it, recorder from KUAC down here, because they were not happy with the audio quality. And, of course, the audio quality was poor, but that was a problem with the LASCOM, not our recorder. So they asked me if we were using the Nagra, and I told a little white line. I said, yeah, and they said, well, that's good. It sounds a lot better. And, of course, we were still using the same equipment we used before, but
the cassette machines.
You know, it was always the lowest quality in the chain, which caused the problem, which was a LASCOM.
It was the phone line. It was basically phone line quality.
You guys have to remember
that for current modern listeners, that this was back in the days of analog recording on thin strips of plastic tape. And the recorder was so heavy because it was steam-powered. I remember because I was the new guy in the shop, and I had to go out and get the wood for the boiler. It was no fun at all.
No, except for the Nagra. It had a squirrel cage with an actual squirrel.
And, John Corso, you were a Coast Guard officer at this time, and also later we were the city attorney for Juneau.
That's right. I went off to law school between K2 Radio and K2 TV, but when I started up, I was attracted to the operation by Tom Prentice, a buddy of mine who had served with me in the Coast Guard District Headquarters in Juneau. And I remember the first days of the station as in the high school. I think it was in the auditorium. It was up in the balcony or something. I did most of my recording at home, but I had to come in every once in a while.
You had real good equipment, and you produced a lot of stuff for us at home.
Yeah, we were in what is now again a storage room underneath the light booth in the high school auditorium. Actually, that was very useful when we wanted to cover things like inaugural addresses or concerts or things like that, because we were able to just get a really long microphone cord and go right down on the stage. Is what we had to do more than once.
You did the commentaries through the first year. That was really good. You were had a commentary for us at least once a week, I think, didn't you, John?
For a while I was doing it once a day, and it was surprising, although I don't expect most newspaper columnists would be surprised by how much work something like that is. And Elaine was doing it every day. I admired her as a very productive woman.
Yeah, well, you were still in the Coast Guard at the time, if I remember correctly.
I had just gotten out.
And just gotten out. And we have one of those commentaries here.
Let's take a quick listen.
Yeah.
There are many thrills in the average life. They are the moments that make the heart pound faster and leave the knees shaky. They are valuable, these moments. They break up the monotony of civilized life and leave you with stories to tell to friends. Most of us go through similar such experiences. In childhood, it's the bicycle ride on the really steep hill. In adolescence, it's the first kiss. In adult life, there's the high-speed automobile ride, mountain climbing, a storm at sea, or gambling. These can all be thrilling moments in a life anywhere, but they lack the incredible danger faced with cool courage by a small group of Americans every day. These dedicated professionals regularly take their lives in their hands in a breathtaking dance with death that would supply many with enough thrills to last a lifetime. I am speaking, of course, of the residents of Alaska's capital city as they drive across the Juneau Douglas Bridge. Why, the very name sends chills up the spine. The J.D. Bridge, the humpbacked horror of Gastineau Channel, the nemesis of door handles and side mount mirrors. Hillary had Everest, Armstrong had the moon, Evel Knievel has the Snake River Canyon, but we have the Juneau Douglas Bridge. Part of the thrill of daring a drive over this bridge, of course, lies in its age and architectural significance. It is a venerable old bridge, sort of a granddaddy of bridges, and one always has the vague expectation that at any moment it may decide to retire into the channel. Another reason behind the hair-raising character of this bridge is its shape. It's sort of an arch. You get a steep hill coming and going. I have been repeatedly assured by knowledgeable people that this is not warpage, that it was designed into the structure, but I have my doubts. It is so impractical. In winter, a layer of ice on this bridge makes going up as easy as an assault on McKinley and coming down as relaxing as skydiving. And summer or winter, this hump in the bridge deprives you of the opportunity of seeing what's coming in the other lane. Will it be a motorcycle or a mobile home? You're not on a bridge, you're on a giant roulette wheel. The greatest thrill of all, though, is caused by the width, or lack of it, of the Juneau Douglas Bridge. It's an automotive tightrope. There's no feeling like the one you get as your brand new wide-track station wagon breasts the rise in the middle of the bridge and you see two school buses, an oil truck, a minibus, and the garbage man roaring up to meet you. You can either flog the wagon over onto the sidewalk or take a chance on losing a few inches off one side of your car. I've been thinking of buying a super wide-track car and riding the suspension arches over the bridge. It wouldn't be much more nerve-wracking than what I go through now. There's no replacement for it, though. And the thrills sought on that bridge by Junoites every day is a testimony to their cool bravado. They drive that bridge because they seek a richer life, because they scorn danger and laugh at death. They drive it because it's there. But mostly, they drive it because there isn't any other way to get to work. For K2 News, this is John Corso.
John Corso, and I'm talking with Dennis Harris and Freddie Koskinen right now about our 40 years of history. A lot of history it was, and John, you were one of those every day?
Oh, I think I did it every day for a while, but sort of tapered off towards the end. I had a little trouble hearing that recording because there was two channels going. I was hearing a saxophone over my voice. As much as I love the sound of my own voice, the saxophone is pretty easy to listen to. But what's sort of interesting about this, at least the sound of those recordings, is how flat they sound. You know, it's almost like a 1940s wartime correspondent sound. Voices back then didn't get processed the way they do now. You know, everybody's has a rumbling baritone for males or a sweet tenor for females, but back in 1974, it just sounded like you actually do. It's kind of depressing.
Well, it's the low bandwidth of the cassette machine is part of it, I think. But
I suppose so.
Yeah.
By the way, I should point out for folks who came to Juneau after 1981. This is the old bridge, the Douglas Bridge, just to stay out of trouble with Douglas folk.
Yep, but we don't have that to kick around anymore, but I'm sure if John was around, now that he's no longer employed by the city, he could find other things to go after.
Oh, that would be fun. It'd be nice to have you back, making commentary without having to worry about... Well, you can imagine what he doesn't have to worry about anymore.
My paycheck, for example.
Yeah.
It's kind of like navel gazing, but it's interesting to find out KTO was passed on. Talk about some of the other early DJs like Lee Fairbanks.
Lee Fairbanks was actually a roommate of Frederick's and mine for a while. Richard DeRue was another one who shuffled in and out of the house that we shared for a while too.
Function Junction.
Yeah, we called it Function Junction. That's right. And then we had the Soul Man. We had Dan McClinton, who came in, and I remember training him and did not know that he had prior radio experience, and went through a whole hour of playing blues and rhythm and blues, and he had brought a whole suitcase full of records with him. And
Dan was there for a long time.
Yeah, he was, yeah, until he left town, as a matter of fact. But he just, you know, once he got the board figured, I seem to be doing pretty good. And I said, well, you got the hang of it. And he said, yeah. Is it okay if I talk? And I said, yeah. And he opened the microphone, and that was all she wrote, because Dan had a style that was all his. And he would just go. And he had, you know, it was a soul train, and it was the way he ran the show. And it was great. He also did a great gospel show on Sunday mornings.
Well, from my memory,
He helped popularize that, in Juneau, gave it a higher profile than it did before. And this was back in 1974, when the number one song of the year was The Way We Were by Barbra Streisand. And Seasons in the Stun was number two. So Dan did some good work.
Yeah, he did. And last I heard, he was still alive down in St. Louis. He's had a lot of problems with diabetes over the last few years, but he's still around.
Cynthia Halterman.
Cynthia Halterman, actually, she became involved in the early days, but her involvement was a lot to do with television. She was had a background in that area and an education degree. Had come to Juneau originally as a school teacher and discovered that teaching 7th and 8th graders wasn't her forte. And started working in the old Governor's Office of Telecommunications Experimental Satellite Communications Program. Alaska was the first state in the Union to do educational television via satellite. And it was an experimental program, and the gentleman that headed it up was Dr. Charles Northrup, who just got a second doctorate last spring here at UAS. An honorary doctorate, and he was a commencement speaker. Charlie brought TV into the equation and was the general manager for a number of years before he moved on to other things here in Juneau, and then eventually moved on to doing the work he still does off and on, which is helping countries that are emerging from dictatorships establish locally owned and operated non-government radio stations, independent news, and and that's what he's been working along with Rich McClure, who was also here at K2 at one time.
Two of the other.
I'll tell you something else about Charlie Northrup. He is a great radio news announcer. Cold Copy Northrup was his nickname at one point in his life. You could hand him a sheet of text saying just about anything, and he would read it through perfect every time, almost.
Sounds like the late Neil Phelps Munson, who was one of the people that actually inspired a number of us when we worked at KJNO, who could come in hungover in the morning and literally wake up and read wire copy cold and go back to sleep during the commercial breaks. But
Neil had two great quotes. One was, never steal anything small. And the other one was that wisdom is the knowledge that things are worse than they were, but better than they are going to be.
Mike Kirk.
Mike, of course, was a gadfly, as was I. I mean, and that's why I always liked Mike, because he was a gadfly. And Mike caused some problems, because he came to K2 because he wanted to do a program about education, even though he was still working as a teacher. And he did, and he rubbed some people at the school district the wrong way, including a certain superintendent that he traveled down south to get the real goods on and come back and let the school board know that they'd really made a mistake when they hired the guy. And lost his job, and then won a lawsuit and got his job back. Unfortunately, we lost Mike just last spring, early summer. Yeah, he was this summer. But he went out in the style he would have liked to have gone out. He paid his way back from Seattle to be medevaced back to Juneau so he could see all his friends before he left us.
Going back to 1974 for just a minute, two other things that happened in that year that were major events were the Capitol move and Nixon's resignation. And, of course, we did programs on both, but Corso wrote a whole bunch of commentaries that year, and more than one, I think, was about, in one way or another, about Watergate. I remember he did one about the presidency Nixon. It was really interesting about the view of the chief executive as an institution. It was a real good one.
I'll tell you what else happened in that. Well, thank you, Frederick. And I'll tell you what else happened in 1974. The Trans-Alaska Pipeline was started.
That's right.
That's true. And I remember when Nixon resigned, we actually carried the speech live from National Public Radio via Armed Forces Radio shortwave. And when it was over, we had made a decision that when it was over, what we were going to do was simply open the phone lines.
Your dad called. You remember that?
Yeah.
He was the one that introduced all of us to the fact that this was the first year of our Ford.
Which harkens back to tonight. Brave New World by Aldous Huxley. Yeah. But it amazed me that the outpouring that we got by just simply opening the phone lines and letting people say what they wanted afterwards. People vented in a number of different ways.
Who was the first employee?
Frederick.
I was.
Frederick was the first employee, and
Cheryl Levitt was the second, and she was replaced by John Mint.
Yeah, that's right. And during that first year, we actually did a fundraiser by remote because there was no way we could have people come visit us and everything. So, and that was the first year that Merchants Wharf opened, and the space that is now the Hangar Ballroom was vacant. And they let us go in there and operate by remote from there. And so we did remote broadcasting from down there for about a week and did a fundraising marathon. And that was our first remote thing. We moved to Main Street in the spring of 1977. We actually started working on the building in the fall of 76. That was a long process because we were using volunteer carpenters and everything. The television operation was already going downstairs before the radio station moved down there because it took us about, I think, about 6 months to build the studios.
We should give a little bit more time to the original studios, though, that were in the high school because they were built almost entirely by David Mitchell. And it was actually a pretty good studio considering the small space. We had two on-air rooms with a major area in between for either guest interviews or board meetings or whatever.
Or music, live music.
And then
music.
We had two areas up above each studio that we could store stuff. You had to crawl on your hands and knees where we'd keep tapes. We had to bicycle tapes a whole lot because we didn't have live radio then, so we had to get tapes in the mail and return them. It was a lot of work, and almost all of it done by volunteers. And we also had a real interesting banner across the top
that,
two studios. It was actually mine. I don't know what happened to it. I'd like to get it back. But Nixon Agnew Listening Post. And the only thing, of course, that made it interesting was in 1974, Agnew had already resigned and Nixon was about to. And
yeah.
And this was back in the day when there was no simultaneous daily television news. KINY would play the television news a day late after videotapes were flown up from Seattle.
Yep.
And sitcoms were a week late.
Yeah.
Yeah, and ball games were usually 5 or 6 hours late because they had to be taped in Seattle and shipped up here.
On television, on radio, they were live, but they had teletype noise in them.
I'm talking about John.
And that was the year that 1974 was the year that Hank Aaron beat Babe Ruth too.
I'm talking with John Corso, Frederick Hoskinson, and Dennis Harris about the history of KTUO. It started on January 26, 1974. General, what was the mood for around the station back then? And how many volunteers did you have?
The mood was very enthusiastic. A lot of people were really enthusiastic about learning about radio, and we had people doing all kinds of programs.
The quality of the programming was a lot better than you'd probably assume hearing about it now, partly because of people like John Corso, who could produce stuff at professional levels at home. But we had a lot of volunteers, and one of the things that made the volunteers as good as they were is the fact that a volunteer usually did a show once a week, sometimes once every other week, which gave them a lot of time to prepare for that 2 or 3 hour show. And in answer to your question, I think in the first month we had about 50 people that were actually on the air as volunteers, and it grew from there.
We had the first opera programming in Juneau, still the only opera programming in Juneau. We had a lot of classical music and a lot of jazz, which didn't air much on Juneau stations. We had a lot of what you'd call album rock, long songs, you know, Inagata DeVita, all the stuff that the commercial stations wouldn't play.
We'd produce our news and public affairs program at 5, and then we'd run a program called Album between 5:30 and 7, and then we'd re-air a tape of the news and public affairs again from 7 to 7:30. In those days, we didn't expect people to stay with us all the time, although I'm sure a lot of people did. But we were actually trying to be an alternative. So, you know, when we had a schedule from the beginning, I think we went on the air, and so we had, I think, just a little less than a week before we started conforming to our printed schedule, but the programs were all block programming, which means that the average listener who was interested in one program might not necessarily be interested in another.
I remember Frederick's slogan or motto or whatever you might call it for community radio in Juneau. I wonder if you remember it, Frederick. It was not just a music box.
Yeah,
that's right. And I remember, too, I want to mention one other member we had who was a great fundraiser and was our treasurer when the first couple of years of operation, Bill Dunn Sr., who referred to our little treasury and was the keeper of the books for a while, and was he looked like Winston Churchill, and almost sounded like Churchill, and loved to smoke bootleg Cuban cigars. And he was an amazing man, a retired banker who looked the part and had a wonderful bass voice. Occasionally I would get him to come on a classical music show with me and talk about the music. But he was just a wonderful
man. Bill was also an inveterate court watcher. He spent years sitting in the back of district court and kept a sharp eye on whippersnappers such as yours truly in district court.
Yes, indeed. Yeah.
We're going to take a quick break for a little bit and play a little series of excerpts of our programming over the past 40 years. John, I think I got rid of the saxophone for you this time.
Thank you.
This is Nancy DiTrini from the Juno Arts and Humanities Council. Happy anniversary, K2.
I come before you upon this occasion not buoyed by a surging electoral groundswell.
Mercy is because mercy don't sound right. I'll treat you right.
Champagne, don't grab the face.
We're witnessing what is usually called a spirit dance.
It's 2:30 in the afternoon in Anchorage, you're shut down.
You're looking all around, y'all listening, y'all trying to keep an open mind. Amazing what you find all around.
Oh, hello, everybody, and welcome to A Prairie Home Companion, a live broadcast coming to you from the auditorium of the Juno Douglas High School here on the main drag in Juno, Alaska.
There are always people who think if they just sit there long enough, good fortune will magically appear from the sky.
And keep their grubby hands off my dividends.
Today, my guest is John Hope, who is a past president of the Grand Camp.
Because true pioneers know that wealth is not money.
Hello to all of you from Juno, serving in Operation Desert Shield.
How come John and Greg can't catch a fish while they're on the air, like click and clack, six cars?
We want to install a larger-than-life-size bronze sculpture of Patsy Ann.
Oh!
This is Terry Armadillo Harvey.
Find out where your candidate stands on the issues. KTOO's Election 78 shifts into high gear this week.
Hi. You know, it wasn't long ago that I didn't even know what news was, let alone try to report it.
You can participate in our general election coverage.
The FCC is coming to town.
To bring you local school news, on Gilbert speaking.
You betcha.
We will ask the legislature to join us in an innovative experiment to encourage more oil development more quickly.
This better be important.
Look, Rivera, we've got a situation.
Well, it's an honor to be here at Centennial Hall.
How does it feel to be on the spot there, Richie?
It's only in Alaska to have a snowplow lead the Olympic convoy here.
It's kind of like the 4th of July in January. Everybody's having a great time.
We were there to learn from them.
From KTOO, this is Katrina. Juno responds, a live radio marathon.
I believe in poetry.
So on the count of three, button pushers ready to go. Here we go. Three,
one,
two, one.
KXLL, excellent radio. I'm Andy Klein.
See what happens when Seju comes to Juno.
This is Kathy from Balloons by Night News, wishing KTOO a very happy 40th anniversary, and thank you for all of your years of service to our wonderful community.
Time is 3:37, and you are tuned to KTOO News in Juno. I'm talking with Dennis Harris and Frederick Hoskinson, and by telephone to John Corso. I'd like to invite everybody to share their memories by email if you'd like to choose that way to do it.
Yeah, well, it's. I can't believe it's 40 years. Am I that old? Are you that old, John?
No, I'm not. I'm quite younger than that.
And John, why don't you tell us what you're doing now?
I'm retired. I am bouncing my grandchildren on my knee and enjoying life with my sweetie of 50 years, Diane, and driving my car and riding my motorcycle and taking photographs.
Uh-huh. What kind of motorcycle, John?
A Ducati 800 SS.
That's what I figured, something like that, yeah. Well, I hope you're enjoying life down there in Washington State. Alaska's still here.
Oh, you know, one other thing I should probably mention among the volunteers in the first year was Walter Johns, who did a real interesting show. He did his own sort of show where he mixed his own music with interviews and other stuff, but it was very definitely one perspective from the Native community. There are lots, but it was one perspective from the Native community, a personal perspective, and it was quite a show. I remember one time he interviewed Cecilia Coons, and there was just a whole lot to that show.
We ended up later on with Cy Peck becoming involved in the station. And,
the Raven.
That's right. And
Cy Peck the Raven.
Yep, well, he's even gone further away than you now. He lives in Maui.
Not a bad way to go.
But, as a matter of fact, Cy did something really amazing one day a few years back. When he called Les Paul on his 90th birthday and interviewed him on the air.
At midnight.
At midnight, right, on his birthday and interviewed him and got it all and put it on the air here in Juneau. It's pretty amazing.
A lot of memories over the past 40 years, that's for sure.
Yep, and... we had some pretty amazing things. One of the funniest things I remember, there was a lieutenant governor, Jay Hammond's first lieutenant governor, Lowell Thomas Jr., son of the famous radio commentator, who lived in Anchorage and was elected lieutenant governor for Jay Hammond's first term. And he had the misfortune to take a trip to South Africa and then make a comment that black people in South Africa seemed to be doing pretty well, and there was a lot of controversy over it. And Steve Nelson, who was, I don't remember if he was a staff member or volunteer here at the time, did a wonderful Jay Hammond imitation. And actually did an imitation of Jay urging everybody to shun Lowell Thomas.
And I had the opportunity to fly next to an Alaska Airlines jet, right next to Lowell Thomas, and I did it. I ignored him. One of my favorite memories is Cy Peck Jr. Trying to describe Bell Blue, who is a local figure of some notoriety.
Oh, Cy Peck at the Folk Festival, I think that would have been like the... It was... Yeah, it would have been like the 1978 Folk Festival, I believe.
From the Alaska State Museum.
From the Alaska State Museum, when it was still at the State Museum. And Cy and Bell Blue, the infamous Bell Blue, came on with big leather boots and a leather bustier and whips. And had a record player playing, or a tape player playing Rawhide while she was snapping a whip. And Cy says, well, I don't know how to describe this act quite, but he was trying to describe it. It was pretty funny.
And then she broke out the machetes and started singing Mac the Knife.
That's right.
I imagine John has his recollections of Bell Blue. He was assistant city attorney then. That was before he became the city attorney, but I'm sure he has memories of Bell Blue.
I do indeed, but this is a family radio station, so I keep it inside.
Well, last I heard, she was still raising horses in South Dakota.
Well, raising horses was better than raising hell, so I wish her well.
Before we let you guys go, I just talk about the many changes that have been happening to KTOO and Karen and KXLL and KTOO TV and 360 North. If you could go back in time and change any one thing, what kind of changes would you make?
Well, I left it 10 years after. I left it 10 years after because I was frustrated. I wanted to produce radio documentaries, and I had a grant turned down by the National Public Radio Grant Review Committee because they couldn't understand why somebody from Alaska would want to produce Celtic music shows and documentaries about Scotland, because I'd been traveling quite a bit. And I was stuck doing paperwork. And I'd been playing around with computers while I was working here and got interested in that and went off and did that. But I didn't want it to be an institution. I didn't want people to be afraid to say something, because my feeling was that if somebody complained about someone's opinion that was expressed on the air, they were perfectly welcome to come down and express their opinion. The microphones were always open.
I agree with that.
And I felt that it had become way too much of an institution, and I wasn't happy here anymore, and I left. And I really wish that it isn't quite as institutional as it is now, that it was a lot more free form, and there would be a wider range of opinion on here than there is. But that's my opinion.
Yeah, well, I think that it's certainly not the fault of Jeff or any of the folks that were involved originally, and a lot of the folks who have been involved through the years are innocent. But I think K2 has fallen into the niche of public radio all over the country, and I think they follow the fundraising methods of other stations too much. We were very unique when we started, but we were successful. And I think we evolved because of the path of least resistance rather than doing it our own way. And I think that's something of a mistake. But besides that, K2 is still a great institution for Juneau, and I don't mean to imply that it's not. But I think it could have done better.
Well, I'll tell you, my perspective is a little different. I was all volunteer, a little bit of radio, mostly TV, and I wouldn't change a darn thing. I thought it was a grand experience, and to this day, whenever I need to put a resume someplace, somewhere on there is listed KTOO Radio and TV, television director and chairman of the board.
Well, I'll tell you one thing that this station did do, and it got a lot of people involved in broadcasting, and one of the things it has done over the years, it has sent a lot of people from Juneau to other places, starting with Linda Ellerbee, of all things, who ended up on national television because she ended up leaving Juneau because she lost jobs at the same time I did, and Frederick didn't. But we ended up with people, everybody from Margot Melnikov, Elizabeth Arnold, Peter Kenyon, Marika Partridge, and a whole group of other people that are all off doing things in national media now, or have been doing things in national media. Sumner, McLeish, just an amazing group of people that came through KTOO, and we provided them with a place to sort of work up their chops before they went off nationally, and I think we should all be really proud of that.
Well, unfortunately, it isn't affordable now, I think, is the real problem. But, John, a lot of the kind of productions you were involved with in television, like local news, just doesn't exist anymore in Juneau.
I'm sorry to hear that. It was a great experience.
I want to thank my guests for coming by today and talking about the history of KTOO, Dennis Harris, Frederick Hoskinson, and also John Corso. Thank you very much for being on the air with us today. Appreciate it.
Well, thanks for giving
us pleasure, gentlemen. Let's do it again at 50.
All right.
Yeah. I'm for that.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday. It's the 22nd of January, 2014. It was on this day, 1938, Thornton Wilder's play Our Town was given its first performance at the McCarter Theater in Princeton, New Jersey, the play about the town of Grover's Corners, New Hampshire. In the first act, Emily Webb and George Gibbs are children together. In the second act, they marry. In the third, Emily has died in childbirth and is looking back from beyond the grave with other dead citizens of Grover's Corner. And she decides to revisit the happiest day of her life, her 12th birthday. Thornton Wilder had trouble writing that third act. He finally found inspiration when he was in Zurich with his friend Samuel Steward, who wrote later that the two of them stayed up until dawn to hear the bells. They were going from bar to bar and drinking. It was raining. They got home, and Samuel Steward fell into bed and slept all day, but Thornton Wilder went to a hotel and wrote the last act of Our Town, beginning with the graveyard scene with the umbrellas. From Princeton, the play moved to Boston. It was sort of a flop there. Boston critics gave it poor reviews, played to half-empty houses. Some of the audience walked out. There were no sets, no props. But two New York theater critics went up to Boston to see it, Brooks Atkinson, Alexander Wolcott. They persuaded the director and producer to give it another try and bring it to New York, where it did better. And then it won the 1938 Pulitzer Prize for Drama. And it is now estimated that on average, Our Town is performed at least once every night somewhere in the world. It's the birthday of Sir Francis Bacon, 1561, in London, philosopher and essayist and champion of modern science. He spent his intellectual life challenging Aristotle's view that knowledge should begin with universal truths. Francis Bacon said, "If a man will begin with certainties, he shall end in doubts, but if he will be content to begin with doubts, he shall end in certainties," and said that scholars should build their knowledge of the world from specific observable details, a theory now known as the scientific method. And it's the birthday of André Maury Ampère, born in Lyon, France, in 1775, who, despite a turbulent life in turbulent times, the years of the French Revolution, made great advances in science with partial differential equations, the wave theory of light. He discovered the element fluorine. He developed his theory of electromagnetism. And his name is used, the ampere, for the unit of measurement for electrical current. Here's a poem for today by Anne Alexander Bingham. It is enough to know that the atoms of my body will remain, to think of them rising through the roots of a great oak, to live in leaves, branches, twigs, perhaps to feed the crimson peony, the blue iris, the broccoli, or rest on water, freeze and thaw with the seasons. Some atoms might become a bit of fluff on the wing of a chickadee to feel the breeze, know the support of air, and some might drift up and up into space, stardust, returning from whence it came. It is enough to know that as long as there is a universe, I am a part of it. It is enough, a poem by Anne Alexander Bingham, used by permission of her family, here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, committed to discovering great poets and printing their verse. Back issues and subscriptions available at poetryfoundation.org. Engineered by Noah Smith and produced by Joy Biles, be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
The Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority encourages businesses and organizations to learn more about employing Alaskans who experience developmental disabilities, traumatic brain injuries, and mental health conditions. When you hire a Mental Health Trust beneficiary, you're not just providing a job. You're providing an opportunity for them to showcase unique skills, a strong work ethic, and a desire to succeed. Learn more at mhtrust.org.
Time is 3:53 and you are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau. Our next guest is Jeffrey Clough from Eagle Crest. Jeffrey, thank you very much for coming in today.
Thanks for having me today, Jeff.
So what's weather like?
Well, I'm not going to lie, it's raining. So it's warm and raining, but the good news is it's not raining on the mountain as hard as it's raining in town. So I think we have that to be thankful for.
And for people who don't know how to ski, you have some packages available?
Oh, we sure do. It's January still, and we have Learn to Ski and Snowboard Month, and we have some great packages available. So during the midweek, we've got some discounts, $10 off, $5 off to learn how to learn to ski or snowboard. And we've got some great Triple Play Learners Pack that'll get you up there for three times. So, you know, don't let this weather scare you away. We have some great conditions up in the mountain. It's spring skiing in January. And I think I've been asked quite a bit over the last couple of days, does Eagle Crest still even have any snow? And we do have snow. And I was out skiing on Monday, and it was fabulous conditions. So, you know, if this was your season to learn how to ski or snowboard, don't give up on it. Come on up and visit us, and you can find out more information at skijuno.com.
What kind of special things do you have to do to prepare the snow for its best appearance?
Well, we've got a whole fleet of snow groomers, snow cats that groom the snow. And what they do is they flatten it down and then groom it and put a nice corduroy touch on it that makes it nice and smooth, easy to ski. It does, this wet snow conditions does become a little bit more of a challenge for the groomers to get that nice corduroy surface that we all love to ski and ride on. But they do a great job up there, Seth and his crew, and we know that they're going to be out there tonight working the snow and making it as great skiing for all and snowboarding for all of us tomorrow.
All right, Jeff, anything you'd like to add? I might have forgotten to ask.
Just wanted to note that we did announce the winners for the 33rd annual Learn to Ski Weekend, which is this weekend, sponsored by Mendenhall Auto Subaru. And you can go to our website at skijuno.com and find those winners. And all the winners will be given a phone call tomorrow and invite them to participate in the weekend.
All right, Jeffrey Clough, thank you so much for coming down.
All right, thanks for having me, Jeff.
This is Bird Note. We think we know robins pretty well. Red-breasted birds of spring that tug earthworms from the ground. Perhaps less well known is that, in winter, flocks of American robins spend the night together. Usually a few dozen to a few hundred birds roost communally in trees or an old barn, or under a bridge. Larger robin roosts can number in the thousands, or even tens of thousands of birds. A remarkable number, until we consider the scene near St. Petersburg, Florida, during the winter of 2007. Observers here counted robins arriving in late afternoon to roost on an island of dense mangrove trees. For 2.5 hours, the stunned census takers watched a steady stream of robins flying overhead. Based on the rate of birds passing by per second, a conservative estimate was 720,000 robins. If the average robin weighs 2.7 ounces, that was nearly 61 tons of robins. The previous year, the same roost hosted a mere 42,000 robins. In 2007, it was likely snow and ice to the north and west that pushed these legions of robins to Florida. And we thought we knew robins. You can share this show with a friend when you come to birdnote.org.
Support for programming is provided by the Historic Anchorage Hotel. Located on the National Register of Historic Places. Founded in 1916 and located in the heart of downtown Anchorage. More information at historicanchoragehotel.com.
Music of Bela Fleck and Chicoria behind us there, appearing in concert in late April here in the capital city at the Juno Douglas High School Auditorium. If you need more information about that, check out the website, JAHC, JunoRisingCommunitiesCouncil.org. Tomorrow at 3 on a Juno afternoon, Shona Strasser will be your host. We'll find out about KTOO's present and future as we talk with General Manager Bill Legere. Pete Griffin will be here to highlight Saturday's celebration. We'll talk with performance poet Buddy Wakefield about his shows this weekend. Get the details about Girl Scouts and singing telegrams, and Nancy DeTruni will be here with Arts Up. At Writer's Almanac, Bird Note Music, and more Thursday on the Juno afternoon. For the forecast for tonight, rain heavy at times, temperature steady around 43 degrees, gust to 35 miles per hour near downtown Juno and Douglas. Thursday, more rain diminishing in the afternoon with high temperatures around 46 degrees. Friday, mostly cloudy skies with high temperatures around 43 degrees. Thank you for tuning in to Juno afternoon today, and have a pleasant evening. Don't forget tonight at 7, a live broadcast of Governor Sharon Parnell's State of the State address live from the Capitol Building. and a KNN, a 20-year retrospective of the first 20 years of the Alaska Folk Festival.
This is KTOO Juneau. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. We rebroadcast on translators K276AF in the Mendenhall Valley and Auk Bay, K269AO in Lemon and Schweitzer Creeks, K201AM in Gustavus, K220BT in Hoonah, and K210AS in Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait. In Juneau, KTOO is on GCI Cable, on digital channel 871. We're also online at ktoo.org. Support for national programming on KTOO comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
The Syrian Peace Conference opens in Switzerland with tensions on display.
After 3 years of suffering, this is my right.
This, we have to have some constructive...